Testing.
My name is Kelly Steele, and I'm interviewing Cindy Dumas in her home in Louisville, Kentucky. Today is September the 14th, 1988, and Cindy will be talking about her experiences as an Air Force nurse in Vietnam during the war. Cindy, where are you from?
I'm originally from Lake Elmore, Vermont, a very small town.
When did you graduate from high school?
1960, down in Orlando, Florida.
Did you travel around a lot when you were a child?
Not too much. Actually, we stayed in Vermont till I was 11 years old, and then my mother and father decided to move to Florida, and so we moved to Florida at that time. And so I really didn't start moving around till I was 18 after I got out of high school.
And when did you join the Army? Air Force.
I joined the reserves when I was 23 because I wasn't sure I wanted to go on active duty. And so I thought about it for a couple of years because at the time I was working in Miami and I enjoyed what I was doing and I didn't really want to move anywhere. But finally in 67, I decided to go on active duty because at the time the Vietnam War was really coming to a head. It was just getting very busy over there. And I went in, signed up, went in November of 67, and the main reason I went in was to go to Vietnam.
Were you trained as a nurse before you went?
Yes. I went into nurse's training from 1960 to 1963 in Jacksonville, Florida.
Uh-huh. And was that with the Air Force?
No, I went. Sure. I paid my own way through.
Okay. So, did you volunteer for Vietnam?
Most of the nurses that went over there did volunteer for Vietnam. In fact, as I said, that was the only reason I went in. I remember I was working in a very busy medical surgical ward in Orlando at the time, and I was coming back from lunch one day, I won't forget it, and there was a newspaper stand, and I could see the headlines on the paper, and I could also see this picture on the newspaper, and it had a buddy bending over, apparently, his friend who was injured over there. And that picture made such an impression in my mind. And I was going back to the ward after lunch, and I thought, what am I doing over here when I could be over there really doing something more worthwhile? So that very afternoon, I went to the recruiter's office, and I said, I want to go on active duty, and I want to go to Vietnam. So the recruiting sergeant said, well, I'll be honest with you. He said, you can't go right off the bat. But what I can do is get you in, and when you get to your first duty station in the United States, you put in a volunteer statement within the first week after you get there, and then your chances might be pretty good of going over there.
Did you have a strong opinion about the war before you went?
Well, at the time I felt that what we were doing was right, because America, every time we've gone to war, we've always won. And I felt that we would win this war too. And at the time I was in my early 20s, and I just felt that I would be more useful over there.
How did your family feel about that?
Well, my mom and dad and my brothers and sisters never tried to talk me out of anything I wanted to do. They knew better than that.
Right.
So when I finally told them that I had applied to go on active duty, they thought that was fine, but they also knew that I might not go to Vietnam. So it was okay for me to go in the Air Force. But 2 months after I was in the Air Force, though, I did get orders to go to Vietnam in February of 68. And I remember calling home that night. I was so excited about going. Of course, I was, but I know the guys going over there weren't. And my dad seemed like he was happy about it. I mean, he came across as being happy about it, because I was. But my mother was like, oh, you are? And I knew then, I thought, well, that's right. My mother wouldn't feel the same way I would, you know, that sort of thing. So I don't think my mother was too keen about it, but everybody else seemed all right about it.
Did your friends, did they have any opinion about it?
At the time, there wasn't any. At the time when I decided to go in, the anti-war movement really was not paramount. And so I never really got any negative feedback from anybody about going.
Did you make any sort of special preparations before you left? Like, you know, did you have a boyfriend or?
Not really. No, I kind of hung loose when I was stationed at Griffiths Air Force Base in Rome, New York, because my main objective was to go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't want to get too interested in anybody,
right.
Which I did not. And so by the time I left with good feelings.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't really leaving anybody or leaving a sweetheart. And I'd only been there 5 months, so I really didn't get a chance to really get to know people that well.
Mm-hmm.
And form any kind of roots like you would if you'd been somewhere for several years.
Right. And where did you do basic training?
Shepherd Air Force Base in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember exactly where. I think it was Wichita Falls, Texas, which is a small town.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We went through 3 weeks of basic, and we had to learn to march and to salute, and we really had a good time. We'd go out to the officers' club every night after class. Of course, we had class like from 8 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock in the evening, you know, and you'd just die in class. But then we did go out a couple of days on field trips, and they did mock disasters, and you had to stay in tents and
mm-hmm.
do calisthenics and. As I said, you had to learn to march and all those things. So, but at the same time, we had a good time, too, because
mm-hmm.
I met nurses from all over the United States, and I think there were about 50 in our class.
Did you feel like that what you learned in basic prepared you?
Oh, no. Basic was sort of Mickey Mouse kind of stuff. I mean, it was just enough to learn, about the military to get you by.
Yeah.
And that was about it.
March, right?
Yeah, that was about it, because... Medical people and nursing personnel were really treated like, I mean, they really wanted you badly.
Right.
And so they just kind of let you go through the motions, but
mm-hmm.
Most of us weren't that military oriented because we lived off base and
mm-hmm.
those kinds of things. So.
And the other women there, were they preparing to go to Vietnam?
No, I would say, the ones I knew, the ones that I sort of stayed chummy with during those 3 weeks, as far as I knew, none of them volunteered to go to Vietnam.
Mm-mm.
I mean, they wanted to go in the Air Force. They wanted to be Air Force nurses, but,
uh-huh.
but they just wanted to go other places, like
right.
within the United States or Europe or someplace like that.
Mm-hmm. Did you all talk about the war?
No, we really didn't. Not that I can remember. That was really strange because it was really starting to build up quite a bit by the late 60, by late 67. But I don't remember us talking about it that much, and I don't even remember if I said anything about the reason I was coming in was to go to Vietnam. I remember I had a roommate who was from the Bronx in New York, and she was really a partier.
Mm-hmm.
But I really don't remember talking about it that much. I honestly don't.
Mm-hmm.
Because maybe at the time it still was something that people accepted and that it was the right thing,
mm-hmm.
that we were doing the right thing. You know, I think maybe if it had been 2 or 3 years later, that would have been different.
Did you have any kind of an image in your mind of what you were getting into? Like, when you thought about it?
I knew the wards would be just big open wards. That much I knew.
Uh-huh.
I knew there wouldn't be private rooms and semi-private rooms
right.
and all that. And I don't know if I was real detailed about it as far as how they would come in, if they would come in by helicopter or by plane,
mm-hmm.
or by ground vehicles. I don't remember any of that except that I knew the wards would be open, and probably 30 or 40 bed wards, and they would be like combat casualties. I did not think of myself like being in a MASH unit or anything like that,
mm-hmm.
because I knew that the hospital over there was large and it was pretty well protected. So it wasn't like being in a MASH unit, out
mm-hmm.
in a little outpost or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I really didn't get into a whole lot of detail. I think I was very idealistic about it
right.
when I volunteered.
Mm-hmm. So when did you arrive in Vietnam?
Well, let's see, I got there in June of 68. In fact, I got there like within about 6 months after I went on active duty, because as I said, I was stationed in New York first and
mm-hmm.
got my orders in February, which was the month that the Tet Offensive
right.
was really going strong. And I had orders to be over there in June. And it so happens that one of the nurses who came to the base in New York the same day I did, she was from California, she and I both wanted to go to Vietnam, so we both put in our volunteer statements two days after we got there, and we both got orders the same day, which was February the 13th, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of weird. So she and I went our separate ways in May to go home on leave, for a month. And then after that, we went to Vietnam. We didn't take the same plane or anything, but we got over there within a couple of days of each other.
Mm-hmm. And where did you arrive?
Well, we flew, I had to fly to McChord Air Force Base in Seattle, Washington, stay overnight there. Then we flew up to Alaska and refueled up there and then came on down, like towards Japan and then on down to Vietnam. And I can remember that was an extremely long flight. I have no idea how long we were in the air. Mm-hmm. Must have been a good 12, 14 hours, probably longer. Because mm-hmm. you're talking about halfway around the world,
right.
10,000 miles
right.
away.
Mm-hmm.
Long way. And I think I remember landing in Da Nang, and I remember seeing just rows and rows of people. I mean, there were just guys all over the place, probably waiting to go to different places and things. I remember that. It was just wall-to-wall people. And I felt so... I thought, I have to get out of here because it was so crowded. I can remember that. And finally, I got a flight to Cameron Bay, which was, I don't know, maybe a couple hours. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was daytime when you landed?
Yeah, I think it was, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And was the flight real crowded?
Yeah, every seat was taken. Uh-huh. Sure. I think I flew in on a, oh gosh. I know I flew World Airways back home, because for some reason you can always remember going back home more than you can going
right,
over.
Right.
But I can't remember what kind of plane I took going over. I really can't. But it was full. Every seat was full. Yeah.
How did you feel when you landed? Were you afraid or?
No, not at all. I was curious. I mean, I was glad to be there, and I was ready to get into work, and I knew I'd be meeting a whole bunch of people from all over. But to me, it was more of a just an exciting time. I wasn't really afraid or anything like that. And I had never heard mortars or rockets or what have you. So I had nothing mm-hmm. to relate to. Nothing to relate to. I mean, I knew the situation over there was dangerous. But yet, when you're that young, you think you're immortal. And you just don't think of anything dangerous happening to you.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I was anxious to get back into get into nursing and get on the wards and take care of the guys and that sort of thing. You know, I'm anxious to get into my little cubby hole or whatever place they had for me to live in and get settled and get to work.
What was the living quarters like?
They were very small. In fact, for some reason or other, I've been caught up on the fact of trying to compare this room to how big our room was, and I had a roommate from California, not the same one I was stationed with in New York, another mm-hmm. roommate. And I'll bet you that our little hooch, that's what we called them, hooches, they were actually aluminum, and they were like crescent-shaped aluminum structures, mm-hmm. is what they were. And, oh gosh, how big would it be? Probably no bigger than this living room, maybe about 10 by 15, mm-hmm. or maybe 12 foot by 16 or 17 feet wide. It was small, but we crowded a bunk bed, two dresser drawers for each one of us, an open out closet for like books and records and that kind of stuff, and then a little tiny living room area with two chairs,
right.
And that would be about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a divider for where the bunk beds were. Mm-hmm. To separate our little living room from our little bedroom.
So it's easy to get things to like fix it up?
Yeah, you could. Like I'd put all kinds of postcards on the walls of the United States and little pictures and things like that to remind me of home.
Right.
Yeah. We fixed it up the best we could. I mean, when you walked in, you knew it was female quarters and mm-hmm. not male quarters. So, and then we had, of course, over there everybody bought a tape deck and taped a lot of songs and stuff because you had time to do those things because, of course, you couldn't go off base and you mm-hmm. couldn't do any driving around or traveling around or anything like that.
So. You were in Cameron Bay?
Mm-hmm.
And relative to other areas, how dangerous was that area?
I would say that Cameron Bay, from the experience I had there for a year and talking to other people, that probably was the safest place over there
mm-hmm.
because it was on a peninsula. Mm-hmm. So it was just connected by a small piece of land. Plus, on top of that, we had a regiment of Korean soldiers that guarded our perimeter, and the Koreans, well, they were excellent guardsmen. I mean, you just didn't have to worry too much.
Uh-huh.
So I felt we were pretty safe. Now the mountains across on the mainland, you could hear mortar fire, not every night, but quite often, and you kind of got used to it after a while, and it just seemed like it was more like background noise after a while. But every once in a while, we got rocketed, the airfield got rocketed, and the nursing and doctor's quarters were not too far from the airfield, but they never got real, real close, okay, because what they wanted to do was rocket the jet planes and those kinds of things. So, but I never felt... I do know that when I came back, 2 months after I came back, I don't remember if I knew about it then, but I read an article just this past year, and in there it said that in August of 69, which was 2 months after I got back, that sappers, which are the VC who infiltrated the perimeters, that's what they call them, sapper squads, they actually infiltrated the perimeters at Cameron, the Army side, because we had both an Air Force and an Army side. And the Army had a convalescent center, sort of a hospital-like, and they overran that hospital and injured about 90 people. So no place was safe, actually.
Right.
No place was safe. So, but I remember having a night, because I knew about the sapper squads, and I remember having a nightmare, and I don't know if I had it just before I left or right afterwards, but I remember having a nightmare where I was working this one ward at night, and you worked 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. shift. It was 12-hour shifts is what you worked. And I was working the Vietnamese ward at the time, and so I was feeding the baby. And it was like about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and these five black pajama-clad guys came into one on the right-hand door, because there was only two doors on each end, and that was it. That's all you had, no windows. And these guys came through the right door and started spreading out, and three of them came towards me and two went down the hallway, and just before they got to me, they had these little sabers rattling of these bayonets, and just before they got to me, I woke up because I thought, oh, they're going to kill me, and of course there wasn't anything you could do, you know.
Right.
But that's the only time I had a dream about something like that as far as fearing anything over there. That was the only time that I can remember. So that wasn't too bad.
So did you work on different wards?
Yeah, the first 4 months I was there, from June to October, I worked mostly hepatitis and malaria. I mean, they had a big medical ward, and it was for patients who came in with hepatitis, which there was a lot of over there, infectious hepatitis, and malaria. Obviously, there was a lot over there, malaria. And the guys with malaria especially were really sick. The guys with hepatitis, they were sick, but they could get up and take care of themselves, but they had no energy, they had no appetite, they were just sort of blah, you know, for about 6 weeks. And so you got to know them pretty well, because they stayed around for a while, because they could not go back to their units until they were strong enough to do their job. Mm-hmm. Now, the guys with malaria were the same way. Their illnesses were long-term, because they would like be really sick for several weeks, and they would run high fevers, and I mean, they would just get really weak and wasted. So they stayed with us for a while, too. And at times we had to put them on cooling blankets to get their temperatures down, especially in the middle of the night, because it seemed like a lot of them hyped fevers in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
And then for a while, I also worked the Vietnamese ward, which was interesting. I had no idea that they took care of Vietnamese over there, but I think it had to do with our civic action program, because we wanted to include trying to take care of the Vietnamese people too. So we didn't take care of any young men, because obviously they were all off at war. We took care of civilians, like old men and women. We took care of babies, especially from orphanages, and many of them were half American, half Vietnamese. And we took care of, like, young women. But for the most part, we took care of very few adults between 20 and 60, because I think they were all gone in the fields or working or off to war. You know. But the kids were really cute. They were half American, half Vietnamese. And a lot of them came in with diarrhea and all kinds of GI problems and things, because of the bacteria and just the personal hygiene over there is terrible, just terrible. So it was, and sometimes we'd get these kids in, they'd be so sick by the time they got to us that they died, because there was just nothing we could do for them. But it was, I enjoyed taking care of them, because I said half of them, they were half American, half Vietnamese, and they were really cute. But it was so difficult for anybody to try to adopt these kids, because the red tape was incredible. But I do remember one Air Force major, we called her Susie Q, and we kept her on the ward for 9 months, because we did not want her to go back to the orphanage. We sort of more or less adopted her on this ward. And so finally, though, he got through the red tape, and he was able to adopt her and bring her home. And we were so glad, because she really looked in America. She was just as cute as she could be. So that was interesting. Mm-hmm. And then for a while I also, I think there were 12 wards, maybe more, at Cameron. I honestly can't remember. Or maybe 18, I know it was big. And it was just one half moon shaped building after another. I remember that. And the first four buildings were air-evac wards, where the guys were flown in and out almost every day. I mean, all you saw Air Force buses in front of these air-evac wards constantly, because they would fly these guys out to like the Philippines or Japan or to California, especially like if they got bad injuries where they could not go back to field, or they were had become injured or ill in some other manner, and they were close to going home anyway. So instead of sending them back to their unit, they would just ship them on home. That's what they would do. And so we kept the guys no more than a day or two. I mean, they were in and out, and you don't remember any of them because you just never got to know them, you know. And we did not get combat casualties directly from the field like your Army nurses did, who were out like right in the middle of where your fighting areas were. But we got them after they'd been bandaged up or somewhat stabilized, and then they came to us, and we would take care of them for a day or two, and then they'd go off to, as I said, out of the country. Now those who were injured, but some of them were just transferred to other wards at Cameron Bay until they got well enough to go back to their unit. Also.
What were the physical working conditions like?
We did have electricity and we did have running water. But like you had community bathrooms for the patients. I mean, there was no such thing as a bathroom in a room because there was no such thing as private or semi-private or anything else. You know, you just had big open wards, and you know, you had maybe three or four stalls for each ward, and that was it. But they did have sinks, and we had one sink in the middle of each ward for the nurses to wash their hands and that sort of thing. A lot of times we had no windows at all because in case we were hit, you'd have shattered glass, so we had no windows. We had one door on each end of the building, that was it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it would get so hot that you'd just have to open the doors on each end to get a draft through there. But we did have air conditioners, which most of the time did work, little window units, and you just make holes in your building, is what you did, essentially. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they worked and sometimes they didn't. But I would say that, from what I can remember, most of the time they worked, but when they didn't and the electricity went off, you just had to open the doors because most of the time it was hot.
Right.
Hot and humid. Right. And you had to make do because like a lot of patients were on suction machines and things like that. And so what you had to do, you had to take a big glass syringe and hook it up to the tube so as to create suction with the bulb. And, you know, you sort of had to make do. You had to be very resourceful when the electricity went off.
Did that happen a lot?
No, not that I can remember. It didn't happen a whole lot, but it did once in a while because I can remember doing those things. And of course we didn't have oxygen machines that you could just plug into a wall, you know, anything like that. We had the oxygen tank, so that didn't affect, electricity did not affect that. The oxygen would still go. Let's see, what else? The conditions. Well, most of the time I would say that we had the medical supplies that we needed, pretty much. I don't remember things being real outdated that we had. We had medications that we needed that the patients ordered. We may not have had the latest medications, but we had what we felt was needed to treat the conditions. And the nurses had a lot more leeway about what they could do with the patients. Like, you didn't have to call the doctor every time you needed something done, like you do here in the States. You were more independent in what you could do. Sometimes you could give certain medications without orders because the doctor prescribed certain things all the time for various conditions. And if it was like a pain medication or something for nausea, most of the time you could give it, and then you just tell the doctor you did, he'd say, fine, no problem. So we had a bit more leeway in what we were able to do. so it was very difficult to come back to the States and think, oh God, I got to get an order just for an aspirin or do this or do that. It would just drive you crazy. And sometimes you would do treatments without doctor's orders too, but they trusted you and you'd just tell them afterwards and they would say fine. Mm-hmm. But of course you didn't dare do that over here. And that was a difficult adjustment to make coming back, because you just didn't have that latitude that you did over there.
Mm-hmm. How did everybody work together?
Oh, great.
Really?
Great. And good. Probably because it was such an unusual situation being over there, and you were really close-knit because you couldn't go off the base. And you stayed in pretty close quarters most of the time, and you worked with the same people, which was nice. Of course, everybody rotated out at a different time because you were there 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
1 year. But I had a roommate though who came over the same time I did, which was great. So we were able to pal around for the whole year and go back home at the same time, which was nice.
Mm-hmm.
But I can remember some of the nurses I worked with, and I remember just getting along really well with them. And we all worked 12-hour shifts. Everybody took their turns. I never remember major complaints because there was no sense in making plans to do things because you couldn't go off base anyway. So you worked 12 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody got a two-week vacation, or R&R is what we called it. But because there weren't that many nurses working, I mean, if you're working 12-hour shifts, so you only had to have two nurses or three nurses to cover a 24-hour period.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't work with that many people. I think maybe we had 5 or 6 nurses on each ward. And by the time you scheduled them, you didn't work with everybody in the same day,
mm-hmm.
obviously.
How long did you have to work there before you got your 2-week R&R?
I don't think it... I didn't take my first R&R till December. I'd been there 6 months. I don't remember that you had to work there a particular amount of time,
mm-hmm.
although I think you were expected to. I mean, you wouldn't want to take your R&R within a couple months after you got in country. You'd want to wait.
Right.
And then I took my second R&R in February for a week.
Oh, for a week each time?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think you could go away for more than a week at a time.
Mm-hmm. Where did you go?
Hong Kong, which was really nice, uh-huh. because my roommate and I had saved quite a bit of money because there was no place else to spend it.
Right.
And so between the two of us, we spent a fair amount of money, and we had clothes tailor-made, and we bought tailor-made jewelry, and tailor-made handbags and shoes and all that stuff. So it was really nice. We had a great time. We did a lot of sightseeing of Hong Kong, but that was a beautiful city. Beautiful city. I mean, when you got there, it was like you were a million miles away from Vietnam because it was such a contrast. It was great.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about 2 weeks before Christmas, so I bought all these gifts for my family and shipped them all back home.
Mm-hmm.
And things were so cheap. I mean, you bought cashmere sweaters for $5 a piece.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we just spent so we couldn't help but spend a lot of money because everything was so cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have some of those things too.
Mm-hmm.
So,
was it easy to get those things home?
To get them shipped home?
You
yeah.
You had to ship them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We had to go through customs or something. I can't remember a whole lot about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember we were able to ship them off directly from Hong Kong.
So your patients, they weren't there for very long periods of time. You really didn't.
Well, the ones with the medical problems, those with hepatitis and malaria, yeah, we did. We did
mm-hmm.
get to know them pretty well. And in fact, some of the guys stayed long enough, and some of them were sort of musically inclined
mm-hmm.
and played guitars, so we were able to round up some guitars for them from different people who lived on the base. And we formed a singing group, and we'd go and sing on the Vietnamese ward, and oh, they just loved that. They
mm-hmm.
thought that was great.
What kind of things did you sing?
Oh, probably songs popular back then.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what we sang, though. But it was fun. That lasted a couple of weeks until some of them got better, you know, and
mm-hmm.
went off to their different units and things like that. But that was always a lot of fun. But you could almost tell the guys who were in combat who would get better. They'd almost have this look of controlled panic in their faces before they would leave. It's almost like you could pick out the guys going back into combat. Because some of them were Air Force, some of them were Coast Guard who did not go into combat roles, but then some of them were Army too, and you could almost pick them out because they were so young. I mean, the average age was like 19, 20 years old.
Right.
So, and there wasn't anything to say. I mean, were you going to say good luck? You know, so you just kind of watched him go. But I remember this one guy, especially blonde, just, I mean, really young looking. I mean, 18, 19 years old. And I can remember, I knew he was Army, and I knew he was combat. And it was like he was just kind of standing there by his bed. And, of course, he had his duffel bag. And it was, you could tell he did not want to go back. He just did not want to go back. And I, for some reason or other, he sticks out in my mind. I'm not exactly sure why. As far as the other men on the Iraq wards, no, they didn't stay around very long. They flew in and out pretty much, or they were transferred to another ward. So I really don't remember. I do remember one, because at the time I was working in the Vietnamese ward, and he had been around for a couple of days, but he was ambulatory. He could walk. I remember him in his Air Force blue pajamas walking through the ward, and he was really a cute little guy. And he insisted on, he had to have a picture taken with me before he left for the United States. So I remember him and I had a picture taken by one of the Red Cross trucks. Mm-hmm. So that was cute. I have a picture of that too. Mm-hmm. So that was neat. That was really neat.
I'm going to turn the tape over now.
Yeah.
What was your question?
What were we talking about? Oh, I was just telling you about the oral histories that I had read mm-hmm. recently, and the different types of
right.
the different positions that yeah. women were in.
Right. And I think for the most part, the Army combat nurses have fairly similar experiences to tell because they mm-hmm. they accepted casualties directly from the field.
Right.
I think Navy did too up in Da Nang. I'm not real sure, but at Cameron Bay, for the most part, we did not have. Direct casualties from the field. Most of the time they came to us after they'd already been someplace else. Okay, because we were mostly in air evac or staging area where they were flown in and out.
Right.
But everybody really had their different experiences, not just among the women, but the men too, because the guys that went over there in combat, that's all they remembered and that's all they could think about as far as how other people would look at Vietnam was through their eyes, not realizing that there's so many other sides to Vietnam that people experienced other than combat. Because I was talking to a guy last night at the VFW post who was a vet and a Marine over there, and he said that when he came back, or at least just recently, and he's talked to other Vietnam veterans who were not in combat situations, and he said, I never even realized that there were other sides to Vietnam besides my own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the fact that some people never saw combat. I think everybody did hear rockets and mortars and everything, that sort of thing. But the fact that people or servicemen actually lived in Saigon, which for the most part there was not any fighting in Saigon, and lived in hotel rooms and went to clerical jobs,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time they were never really safe over there because certainly their rooms or dorms could have been infiltrated. Or they could have blown up, or bars were blown up at night, and those kinds of things. So you never were safe, no matter where you were over there. Plus, I think I would have felt more unsafe in something like that because there was no real perimeters or barricades to those hotels as you would on a base.
Mm-hmm.
See, so I'm not so sure that they were better off than anybody else. So, but everybody certainly had their own experiences over there. Like the Air Force mechanic had a different experience than somebody who was in combat out in the field.
Right.
Nurses had different experiences from USO entertainers. You know, I mean, there were many different sides to Vietnam, and mm-hmm. not just one.
So, did you, when you were over, did you feel like that you had a purpose in
yeah.
being there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did. I really felt like I was at home over there in regards to my goal of being there and helping the guys out. Because I can remember at night, especially if it was somewhat quiet, especially on the malaria and hepatitis ward, the guys would come up and talk to you in the middle of the night. Some of them had just a hard time sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
And they might have only been over there a few months, but they would always ask, what is it like back in the States? You know, it's like they had been gone for years, because when you're over there, sometimes it seemed like you had been gone forever. And I would say, well, it's probably the same as when you when it was when you left. I said, what was it like when you left? And then I would usually tell them, well, that's the way it is now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it seems like eons go by when you're over in a strange country like that, because mm-hmm. it's so different. Because there's nothing over there you can relate to in regards to America, as far as the living conditions, the people, what they look like, the environment, which was a very hostile environment,
mm-hmm.
The weather, the seasons. It was just, there was just a million and one adjustments to be made. You know, I mean, it was so totally different from home. The situations under which some of these people lived, some of the, I don't know, just, and they probably experienced all kinds of emotions that they never experienced at home, like the total fear, or having to look at things that just horrified them, those kinds of things, and just being pushed to the limit and feeling just absolute abject tiredness and probably depression and cynicism and all that. And it, when you're talking about 18, 19 year olds, it's very difficult for people that age to put up with all that, unless you have a very good, strong family background, a lot of support, those kind of things. A lot of those kids didn't. A lot of them were poor and were, minorities. And it was difficult for them to try to make sense out of what was going on. But as far as feeling right about it, yeah, I felt right in going over there to help our people. I really did. And I really didn't mind taking care of the Vietnamese, the babies, the children either. I really didn't. That was an enjoyable thing to do. But after I was there for a while, I can remember one day dawning on me thinking, we're not winning this war. This was in 69. And I began to feel some cynicism creeping into me. Because I did go over there very idealistic when I went over there. I really didn't. I felt we were doing the right thing and we were going to win the war. And I was going to take care of the guys and all this other kind of stuff. And then I remember, for some reason, that year seemed like an eternity. It really did. And I was really anxious to get back home. Because it just seemed like we weren't getting anywhere. I mean, it just seemed like one day was like every other day. And you didn't hear of any big victories, or you didn't hear of the VC retreating or the North Vietnamese retreating or anything like that. It just seemed to be the same every day. And I knew the war had been going on for several years before that, and so it just didn't seem like we were making any progress. So I came back sort of not the same way I went,
mm-hmm.
cynical, and just not wanting to talk about it, because I thought, we're just not really doing anything over there. And I felt sort of ashamed about that and being a part of that. At the same time, I don't think it was our fault.
So do you feel like when it was time for you to leave, were you ready to come home?
Oh, yes. I was very ready to come home, very ready. I was ready to come home and have privacy and have a big place to live in and be able to drive a car and not having things break down and being able to just have the freedom to go where you wanted to, when you wanted to, you know, without being confined to a base or a particular area. And to be able to work finally 8-hour shifts and have 2 days off a week and all this other stuff. So
mm-hmm.
that's, yeah, I was anxious. Plus I wanted to see my family and just get back to the United States. Gosh, I mean, you know, like there's no fast food places over there. There was nothing. Yeah.
What was the flight back? Were there a lot of people?
Yeah, it was crowded again. I remember that. We took off from Cameron Bay, and it was really a strange feeling because I can remember looking out the window and seeing the coastline receding. And it was the strangest feeling. It was like, I'll never see this place again. And at the same time, I realized I was leaving something very significant behind, too. But the plane was very quiet, and I think it was different from coming over, because I remember it was noisier and people were chattering going over. But it was very quiet coming back, because obviously planes were filled with people who'd been there for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those people had experienced some horrendous things. And I'm sure in that 1 year, you know, they all changed dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
Dramatically. But I remember it was quiet. And it might have been a sense of relief and a sense of just being tired and finally getting home, too.
Where did you come home to?
I think we flew into, no, we flew into Washington, my roommate and I, and then we caught a plane to San Francisco. And we stayed in San Francisco for 3 days and stayed at the St. Francis Hotel because we decided we were going to do it up big because we were finally home. So we stayed in San Francisco, St. Francis Hotel, and we really had a good time. I can't remember exactly what we did, but we went and ate Chinese food or Japanese food after just coming back from the Orient. That's what we did. Uh-huh. And we rode the cable cars and those kinds of things. So we had a good time. And then we flew down to La Mesa, California, which is where she's from, and I stayed with her for a week. Because we had to get used to time change, too, because you're talking about 12-hour time change. And it took us about 5 days to finally reacclimate ourselves to Pacific time. Then after that, when I had acclimated myself, then I went on to Florida to go back home. And I can remember getting off the plane and getting in my car and just feeling wonderful driving my car. After 1 year of not driving, it felt great. Mm-hmm. What freedom.
What was your family like when you got home?
Oh, they were very happy to see me. Yeah. Very happy to see me. Mm-hmm. My brother, John, my youngest brother, went over there like 2 weeks before I got back. Mm-hmm. And he was trying so hard to get in touch with me. He was in the Army. And he was at Benoit, I think. And he was trying to get in touch with me. And somehow or other, I found out he was at Benoit. I don't know if he tried to call me or somebody gave me that message or whatever it was. But I didn't realize it, but he was, for a week before I left, he was at Cameron Bay on the Army side. But for some reason or other, he was not able to contact me. I don't know what the problem was. So here he was, not that far away from me, and we didn't see each other for 2 years. I didn't see him until, of course, after he came back. Mm-hmm. But luckily, he was not in an infantry unit over there. He was a cook, which was fine. I mean, somebody had to do the cooking and those kinds of things over there. So he was a good cook. Because he did that stateside, and so they remembered that, I think, and they made him a cook, and he stayed that way. But he did go out on patrols, though, from time to time, and he did do guard duty, watching the big fuel drums and things that were at Cameron to make sure they wouldn't get blown up and things. So he did do some things, but he was not in actual combat, though.
Were you still in the Air Force when you came back?
Yeah. In fact, I had a chance for an early out because I only had 6 months left when I left Cameron. And they said, if you want an early out, we'll give it to you, or you can extend. Because it was a two-year tour of duty, you know, when you first went on active duty. It was 2 years and I'd already done 6 months in New York. I had done a year in Vietnam, so I had just 6 months left. So I said, well, I will stay in the Air Force for a year, another full year, if you will station me in Florida, not too far from my family. So they stationed me at Eglin Air Force Base, which is a good 8 hours drive from Orlando, but that's okay, I still got Florida. You know, so that's what I did for a year. And then I got out and went back to school. That was a mistake going back to school because at the time, I really didn't feel that ashamed about having been in Vietnam, but I didn't talk about it that much either. Because at that time, it was very unpopular. I mean, the anti-war protest movement was really at its height, 69, when I came back. And so I thought, oh, the best thing to do is not say anything. So I didn't really say anything much to anybody. But I got up to give a speech class when I went back to school in 1970. Of course, the war was still going on. And I mentioned something about having been in Vietnam, that I'd been in Vietnam for a year, and I had come back a year ago. And my God, you would have thought I'd said the worst thing in the world, because the students' faces changed radically. It was like, you hate me. It was like, what a horrible thing to do, you know. I mean, I remember that, because I remember their expressions changing. I mean, they became stone-faced. It was incredible. I was, and I didn't just dream that up either. I mean, I didn't just make that up. I saw their expressions change. And so I thought, whoa, I just said the wrong thing here. So obviously I didn't mention anything anymore about it.
Did anybody say anything to you after that day?
No, not a word. Not a word. Not at all. And so I'm not much for talking about things or experiences, period, until I really get to know people very, very well. So I don't even know if I really talked to my family that much about my experiences over there. I don't think I did. Although I did write letters home. Mm-hmm. And I did ask my mother last month when I went home on vacation, because I'm really getting interested in this aspect of my life now. Mm-hmm. I said, do you have any of my letters from Vietnam at all? Because I know, and I would love to have them. Mm-hmm. But see, she moved in the meantime from mm-hmm. the house where they were in when I went over there. Mm-hmm. And she, I don't think she kept any of them. But mm-hmm. that just really upsets me. Because mm-hmm. there's not a one that has been saved from, and I would love to have, I would just love to have. But that's the way it goes.
Mm-hmm. What made you decide to come to Louisville?
Well, I went back in the Air Force after I completed a couple years of college in Florida. Mm-hmm. And I went to, I decided to go back in 72. And I had a choice of six places, and they were all in continental United States, okay? And I kept waiting for orders and kept waiting for orders, and I thought, what's going on here? I waited about 3 months and no orders, and that's unusual. So I went to my recruiting sergeant. He called headquarters in Texas to find out about my orders. Something had happened, but somebody had misplaced them or something, but mm-hmm. that's why I wasn't getting them. So all of a sudden they decided, well, we'll give you a quick assignment here, so they stationed me in Alaska, which couldn't have turned out any better. So I'm mm-hmm. glad they lost my original orders. Uh-huh. So I went to Alaska for 3.5 years, which I thoroughly enjoyed, and then I decided I wanted to go back to school to finish up my bachelor's degree in nursing, because mm-hmm. I had not finished it. And so Air Force gave me a choice of three schools I could go to. So one of the schools was here at Spalding University, because mm-hmm. I had family in Illinois and Ohio, or Illinois, Virginia, and Florida, so I wanted kind of a middle place. Mm-hmm. So I chose Louisville, and they okayed Spalding University for me, because they had to okay the school. And so that's how I got here to Louisville. Mm-hmm. And after I finished my training, getting my bachelor's degree, then I had another year and a half to go in the Air Force. I went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, and stayed up there for a year and a half. Then I got out and came back down here mm-hmm. because I knew people down here, and I wasn't that far away when I was up at Dayton, where I could keep in contact with people I knew. So I came back down here, that's what I did.
Mm-hmm. Where do you work today?
I work with the Visiting Nurse Association, and that's the first job I landed in 1980, January of 80, and I have been there ever since, making home visits mm-hmm. and things. So I enjoy that. I'm a supervisor now, mm-hmm. I'm a supervisor of nursing specialists, but I've been there for 8.5 years.
I'm going to turn the tape off now.
Yeah.